ladies and gentlemen, dear intellectuals, you realize that the non-intellectuals are all next door, occupying themselves with topics more practical than culture and anarchy. When I say intellectuals, I must quote a definition of the term, since this afternoon did not quite manage to do this. Thank you. In 1964, the Brockhaus, which is the German encyclopedia, published a new edition, and one of the leading intellectuals in Germany...
I don't think they're hearing yet.
It's better now?
Yeah.
Thank you. So the Brockhaus issued a definition, or a new edition, and attempted to define the term intellectual. One of the leading intellectuals looked the definition up and was appalled. There it said, an intellectual is somebody who cannot quite cope with his brain. Promptly the definition was attacked and has been dropped since. It is my thesis for tonight's little speech that the present crisis of Western culture is rooted in carelessness towards language. While abhorring, in general, such sweeping generalizations, this conclusion, I think, should be drawn from the debate on brightness and youth which took place this afternoon. It was said that today's bright young tend to be politically left-leaning. I propose that the adjectives bright and left are mutually exclusive, and I will attempt to prove it with one if. If leftism denotes a belief in man's inherent goodness and in man's basic equality with others, then this belief is incompatible with scientific findings. If leftism, socialism, means to draw from each one according to his abilities and to give to each one according to his needs, then leftism is irrational. It ignores human nature, it is utopian, and therefore irrational. Several years ago, I opened the Sunday magazine of the New York Times. There was an article on the University of Wisconsin, which I understand is right around the corner. I've never been there. The article commenced, quote, in medicine, there are 33,000 students, comma, all bright, unquote. I did not read any further. The article's author was a young sociologist from Columbia University. Obviously a fraud, for he had stated what cannot be proven. We have read often, all of us, that today's young generation is the brightest that ever has been on earth. While we may have voiced certain doubts, we rarely ever asked for the proof. How do you establish evidence for brightness? Have we not, all of us, fallen victim to intimidation by the young? Having daily contact with the young, both within and without the seminar room, I am forced to conclude that many students are pitifully uninformed about the world, past and present. Yet, they pretend to know a lot about the future. The glorification of youth is perhaps not an American invention. Yet, nowhere are the old and the non-young so intimidated by youth. The fall of Harvard and Stanford and Columbia and Cornell in the late 60s was indicative also of appeasement politics within the academy. Yet it was primarily caused, I think, by failure to recognize language as the only means for rational discourse. The adult world, trained for years to adore youth and its brightness, no longer had the arms for calling the young bluff. Let us suggest and perhaps even enforce an experiment. Let's outlaw the words brilliant and bright for a couple of years. Let's replace them with commonsensical, hitherto an irreplaceable component of brightness. Cultural anarchy. It's not a lecture. My paper is unstructured. When hearing the topic, I immediately remembered Matthew Arnold, whom we had to read in East Germany, not in West Germany later on. Matthew Arnold, in Culture and Anarchy, written in 1869, depressed by the disappearance of faith, deplores the language of churchmen. He criticizes the liberal and radical economists. He finds the scientists wanting, and he turns in desperation to literature to render a standard of conduct for mankind. Before him, Shelley had concluded in his defense of poetry that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. He had refused by then to demand that they be acknowledged. Plato thought that poets were, by their very nature, debarred from being responsible citizens of the ideal republic. To him, the summit of Parnassus is no breeding ground for civic virtues. Where civic virtues count, poets disturb the peace. For Plato, then, poetry and social responsibility are mutually exclusive. Arnold, of course, was not so much concerned with poetry as he was with language. He thought, with Wordsworth, that uncorrupted common speech, enriched by passion and imagination, draws mankind together. Whereas utilitarian speech patterns of politicians and economists would finally destroy mankind. Neither Matthew, Arnold, nor Wordsworth could foresee the times when poets would engage in the utilitarian speech patterns of professional politicians, thus making a mockery of both poetry and politics. Amongst Germans today, and perhaps even amongst Americans, the German writer Günter Grass is better known for his political announcements than for his literary works. A typical confession, quote, "I am a social democrat, because to me there can be no socialism without democracy, and because an unsocial democracy is no democracy." This certainly is a statement, yet it is empty of contents. We can assume, after quite a couple of centuries of democracy without socialism, that there can be democracy without socialism. Closer to home, to your home, and in the year of the woman, let me quote a few American intellectuals. You might protest when I call the first name an intellectual. In her most recent book, called You Can Get There From Here, Ms. Shirley MacLaine reports on the identity crisis which befell her during her visit to mainland China. Quote, "The notion of freedom was suddenly suspect. In American terms, there were no freedoms here of the variety we cherish. No freedom to publish, no opposition political parties, no freedom to write books or create works of art. But there were other freedoms. Freedom from starvation, freedom from discrimination, from exploitation, from slavery, and early death." According to Ms. MacLaine, mainland China has proven over the last three decades that it is, quote, "possible somehow to reform human beings." And here they were being educated toward a living communal spirit through a kind of totalitarian benevolence, unquote. For Miss McCarthy, Mary McCarthy, it took a trip to Hanoi to discover the shortcomings of Western democracy and freedom. In official North Vietnamese eyes, she says, freedom of criticism is nothing more than an additional capitalist luxury. And Miss McCarthy concurs. There's no reason for being proud of the New York Times' freedom to report on police brutality or on air and water pollution through capitalism, if and when these reports do not cause countermeasures. Later on, when finding out that the West German Dr. Kreinig and his wife were murdered by the Viet Cong in Hue in 1968, they were on an aid mission to Vietnam. Miss McCarthy regrets that the couple has not fallen victim to North American bombs. Quote, that would not have hurt their feelings, end quote. Yet another U.S.-American intellectual, in quotation marks, the writer-critic Susan Sontag, observed in her book Trip to Hanoi, 1968, that the word democracy is mentioned more frequently in North Vietnam than in other communist countries. The reason? The North Vietnamese are convinced that the tradition of democracy is deeply embedded in the culture and customs of the Vietnamese people. Are Ms. McLean, McCarthy, and Sontag then cynics? For surely, their contemptuous treatment of established Western terms cannot be explained in terms of sheer naivete. When once Confucius was asked by one of his disciples what he would do first if he had to administer a country, he answered, the first would be to correct language. But surely, his disciple answered, this has nothing to do with the matter. Why should language be corrected? The master's answer was, if language is not correct, then what is said is not what is meant. If what is said is not what is meant, then what ought to be done remains undone. If what ought to be done remains undone, morals and arts will decay. If morals and arts decay, then justice will go astray. If justice goes astray, then people will stand about in helpless confusion. Hence, language must not be allowed to deteriorate. This matters above everything. There have been times in Western culture when the writer considered himself a guardian of language. Imprecise language was held to be proof of imprecise thought. And he who used the vocabulary of extremism was thought capable of carrying out extremist acts. We can no longer make such assumptions, for one of the most singular characteristics of contemporary radical political literary debate is the use of a very extreme vocabulary, which upon close examination reveals neither depth nor sincerity. Quote, revolution remains necessary in all societies in which there are, for example, subordinate racial groups, landless land workers, hired hands, the unemployed, and suppressed or discriminate minorities of any kind. Revolution remains necessary in these circumstances not only because some men desire it, but because there can be no acceptable human order while the full humanity of any class of man is in practice denied. Unquote. The writer quoted here is not Frantz Fanon, who is the wretched of the earth, sincerely encouraged and in practice stimulated revolt. It is a respected English literary critic, Raymond Williams, in his book, Modern Tragedy. Let me repeat. There can be no acceptable human order while the full humanity of any class of man is in practice denied. What is full humanity? We all know there is no answer to this, yet it is used dogmatically. This statement will be signed blindly by a vast number of contemporary intellectuals. In the name of humanity, and for the sake of equality, they will advocate the destruction of the existing order. To them, the ideals of Western culture have become questionable or even meaningless. To them, liberty, in being only itself, is of little or even of no account at all. What good is freedom, they'll ask, when it does not abolish poverty and war, racism and pollution? Freedom is measured in terms of social justice. Liberty is considered a vehicle on the path to equality, or equality in quotation marks. Today's progressive writer seems to worry little about the exact nature of the society which will grow and prosper after the present one has been destroyed. The act of destruction overshadows the future task of construction. It is necessary to overthrow that which is, in order to be able to establish that which should be, said the Russian arch-romantic anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, who has found so many followers within the ranks of today's intellectuals. Yet Bakunin knew of the nature of revolution. Quote, "Revolutions are not child's play, nor are they academic debates in which only vanities are heard in furious clashes, nor literary jousts wherein only ink is spilled profusely. Revolution means war, and that implies the destruction of men and things." Referring to socio-political conditions in today's West Germany, that country's, my country's, most popular, most prominent writer, Heinrich Böll, wrote in the left radical political magazine Konkret, quote, "Zersetzen, zersetzen, zersetzen. Zersetzung ist hier die einzig mögliche Form der Revolution." Which means, in West Germany, the only possible form of revolution today and necessary form of revolution is subversion, subversion, and subversion. The political cultural climate in West Germany today, one can generalize, and never has there been so much talk of repression, but never has there been so great a degree of civil and artistic freedom. Far from curtailing personal liberty, the government seems unable, even when it is willing, to set any significant limits on the freedom to speak, the freedom to publish, the freedom to vote, the freedom to worship, the freedom to assemble, and the freedom to associate. The provisions governing both due process and equal protection of the law are more stringently enforced than ever before in German history. There is no censorship of any kind to speak of today. The rights of dissenters have over and over again been either respected by the authorities or were not respected by the authorities, affirmed and vindicated in the courts. Yet violent complaints persist. At least two of the statements just made will be disputed. It will be said that there is censorship in the arts, and that there are legal limits imposed on the freedom of speech. The proof most frequently quoted nowadays is the Radikalenerlass, a rule which denies to members of certain political groups or parties permanent employment with the government. The rule's main victims so far have been political radicals of both the left and the right, who by virtue of public statements or membership pledges have demonstrated their determination to destroy the present system of constitutional government. Their freedom of speech apparently is considered as absolute as the government's duty to foster its own destruction. In January of 1975, the cultural section of the Foreign Office in Bonn voiced public regret at the nature of a West German art exhibition in London. Perhaps you will know about this, Mr. Wurzheim. It was a German week. Within the framework of an official German week, the painter-designer Klaus Steck from Stuttgart had shown posters of his own design and imagination depicting leading members of opposition parties under embarrassing and or insulting circumstances. The entire venture had been financed by the Foreign Office, that is, the German taxpayer. Nowhere did the official statement of regret by the German foreign minister dispute the artist's right to produce and exhibit his poster. It merely reconsidered the wisdom of having enabled this artist to exhibit his mockery of German politics at the expense of the taxpayer. The outcry was deafening. Charges of censorship were and still are flying. Public radio and TV channels, there are of course no others, and public channels, accused the government of censorship. I beg your pardon? And nobody was more vociferous in denouncing the government than Heinrich Böll. He stated his intentions of boycott. He would henceforth refrain from representing German culture abroad. While it is to be hoped that Heinrich Böll would stick to his decision, there is no guarantee that he will. The vanity of the celebrated artist is outdone by his lack of logic only. Thomas Mann, pretty much of a ballerina himself at his later age, would have called Böll's rhetoric ballerina politics. One is reminded of Goethe's dictum, quote, liberty and equality can only be enjoyed in a state of giddy lunacy. Rumor has it that men of letters have definite virtues. They do not wear blinders, they are honest, they are intolerant of censorship, and they are skeptical of all authority. Are they really? In the case of the West German literary establishment, which dominates or even monopolizes the state-owned media, these virtues are basically non-existent. While demands for ever more freedom are being brought and telecast, intolerance towards the very feeble opposition increases. When the Ullstein Publishing House in Berlin decided to sponsor the creation and operation of the journal Continent, a representative mouthpiece of the exiled Ukrainian and Russian intellectual elite, it was Günter Grass who attacked the venture in rather illiberal terms. Permit me to quote from his letter. It was printed, copied from Encounter, which had the wisdom, foresight to publish both Günter Grass' letter and Zinyavsky's answer. Günter Grass writes, he had been invited to comment, so he said, I follow the invitation. I take the liberty of telling you, without mincing words, what I think of your project. It should, after all, be known to you that as authors in the journal Continent, you will be working together with a certain power empire, famous under the name of the Springer Concern, whose reactionary intolerance is an expression of the same mentality which, under different ideological markings, forced you and the Soviet Union to protest and to resist. I cannot understand how you, as writers with moral criteria, could, through such a collaboration, offer support to a power complex so dangerous to Western democracy. In terms of politics, the ideological anti-communism of the Springer Concern is only a reflex action in response to Leninism and Stalinism. Just as Western private capitalism and communist state capitalism can find themselves united throughout the world when it comes to blocking a third way and to repressing, whether in Chile or in Czechoslovakia, democratic socialism, so is the Springer Concern a part of that power of money or statism, whose corrupt activities both you and I fear so much. Must one, in order to express a justified opposition to totalitarian communism, seek support from those forces who were never seriously annoyed by Western dictatorships, and who in anti-communist blindness are altogether prepared to drive out the communist devil with a fascist Beelzebub? And he finally disproves again. And the answer by Andrei Sinevsky. Dear Günter Grass, I found it very strange to read in your open letter to Alexander Solzhenitsyn and myself that we will be contributing to the new journal, that this contribution would be collaborating with certain dark forces and with the power empire of Axel Springer, and thereby becoming, if unwittingly, accomplices of fascism. I am not very well acquainted with the situation in the West. I have no experience at all of the conflicts within Western democratic societies, and it is not really my business to conduct investigations into this or that publishing house, or this or that moneyed power, in order to decide whose financial support may be better or worse. Your apparent point of departure is a partisan struggle between various groups. But our concern, mine and those of my friends, is simply the magazine, Continent, itself. Our venture is, to my mind, a challenging and promising beginning, a journal which attempts to bring together a whole group of writers in Eastern and Western Europe, among them not a few in Russia, whose work is done in the shadow of the prison camps and lunatic asylums. This, our new journal, which once in a democratic spirit to keep strictly above all parties, is now being helped by the old and traditional German publishing house of Ullstein Propylaen, a house which was destroyed by the Hitler regime. It is a publishing house which asks nothing of us. There are no guidelines, we shall write as we please. Or can it be that you actually believe that we can be made to dance to somebody's tune? Do you doubt that it will be shared, it will be the shared ideals of liberty, generosity and tolerance which will shape our editorial cooperation. The phrase Springer-Konzern, dear Günter Grass, comes from your lips in a very malicious tone, not unlike the phrases about the Tito clique or the fascist de Gaulle, with which they used to frighten us so long in Russia. Again, without going into the affairs of the concern, for I know little about them, I would like to observe that this is bad company, even if one were to judge them by the criteria of your letter, that this company has not killed a single author or sent one poet to a concentration camp. Your comparison of the activities of the group with the publishing conditions of present-day Soviet Russia with a ruling state system bent on destroying all dissidents is, forgive me, simply scandalous. Can it really be that you equate a Hitler or a Stalin with a distasteful polemic in a newspaper? Can it be that you do not know that the whole press, including all publishers of books and magazines in present-day Soviet Russia, is not only under the complete financial control of the Central Committee's Department of Agitation, bolstered up by the state security forces deployed to keep an eye on all the works of Soviet writers? The free writer in present-day Russia is put on par with the criminal and the lunatic. But these are supposed to be liberalizing days. Yet I'm afraid I cannot see the least comparison between an honorable Western publishing house and the Soviet secret police. And it is the same secret police which controls cultural life in the East European lands. You once came to my personal defense. I will always remember it with gratitude. But had you been sentenced for this personal and individual opinion to 7 years in a work camp, then I think you would appreciate a little better the distinction between publishing in East and West. I can understand this much, that you think in other categories, that you concern yourself with who is behind what and why, and who in secrecy and with clever financial tactics influences political life. Back home, it used to be referred to as the claws of imperialism. But in the meantime, we have ceased to look at history with the eyes of a detective. We have gone through the concentration camps, and money will neither buy nor intimidate us. Heinrich Böll and Günter Grass, no doubt, are considered the leading intellectuals today, perhaps even in Western Europe. You know that Heinrich Böll was awarded the Nobel Prize. And it can be safely said that there is no greater establishment today in Western Germany than the establishment of literary critics and litterateurs. They consider themselves avant-garde. Artists considering themselves avant-garde not in the field of art, but in the field of politics. There are similarities, I think, to American life. Several years ago, the American critic Hilton Kramer stated in his essay, The Age of the Avant-Garde, a very far-reaching observation. We see in our days, he says, the institutionalization of the avant-garde in museums and foundations, publishing houses and universities. Far from encountering opposition or general hostility, the avant-garde finds itself subsidized by the public, through the public purse, and by major institutions. By the end of 1974 in the United States of America, the arts received subsidies from the government amounting to $80 to $100 million annually. No longer can there be, in America or in Western Europe, any talk of the avant-garde being the underdog in society. No longer is there the isolation and loneliness, the minority position, which was once considered the very essence of the avant-garde. Hilton Kramer went as far as to say that the avant-garde today is America's only establishment. This certainly holds true of Western Germany. Furthermore, the attitudes of the avant-garde has been adopted by vast numbers of intellectuals in newspapers and universities. The values traditionally associated with the avant-garde, especially its hostility towards the bourgeoisie, have spread. What used to be the épaté le bourgeois is now down with the middle class. The very concept of the intellectual has been widened, together with the advance of the avant-garde into an intellectual mass movement. You might recall this afternoon it was said the young intellectuals in Harvard, I assume this is the students. This is an example, I think, for the devaluation of terms which is occupying us day after day. I do not believe that you can be an intellectual at the tender age of 20. You will certainly be tempted to inquire into the nature of things and of the world, but that term should remain reserved for those who lead a rather lonesome existence. Today, intellectuals can be seen in groups pursuing a particular political-cultural goal. They have their own pressure groups. One of the major aims of the avant-garde throughout the most recent years has been the elimination of the traditional distinction between high culture and low culture. More than that, the coining of the term low culture during the post-war period and the subsequent conquest of positions hitherto occupied without serious challenge by high culture through low culture must be interpreted as a very successful attack on Western culture. The attack, we should not forget this, was spearheaded by avant-garde in all of its contemporary forms. I do not know if all of you were here this afternoon. There was the example of a professor who left Harvard in order to teach at Dalhousie. Professor Fergelin, I understand, mentioned this gentleman. I don't know him, I feel sorry for him. Not because he's now teaching at Dalhousie, it's a perfectly proper little university, but he now lives in Halifax, which is an awful place as compared to Boston. What I mean to say, do we not place too much emphasis upon the students in the classroom when deserting a university, a place of inquiry, intellectual inquiry, in order to, if I may drive the logic of Professor Fergelin to the extreme, has he left bright and leftist students in order to teach stupid and right-leaning students? If that were so, I understand our culture would be truly endangered. My theory being that we are careless, first of all, in applying the term bright to a majority of the young, and by at the same time forgetting that the professor does not teach the students primarily. He teaches his subject. Thank you.